All right, folks, let's go ahead and get started. My name is Venkat Gattamneni, and welcome to the session titled Windows Azure in the Enterprise. In this session, what we'll try and do is cover the first part of the session is basically introducing Windows Azure to you. And the second part of the session is I will take you through a few scenarios for you to get started in the Windows in your enterprises. So that said, this is not really a deep technical session, right? Because we're trying to cover a lot of services in a short period of time. What I'll try and do is give a general introduction to Windows Azure with some hands-on approaches to starting out with Windows Azure. Before I begin, can I have a show of hands? How many of you have already used Windows Azure or are using Windows Azure? Okay, that's a good number, about 50% of the room. Another tricky question. How many of you think the pronunciation of Azure is Azure and not Azure? A few of you. It's funny because if I had asked an American audience the same question, I would have seen the whole room go up like that. But anyway, that's a top question I get, by the way, all the time. What's the right pronunciation? The real answer is there's no right pronunciation. Call it whatever you want. Just use it. So let's go ahead and get started, dive in. So before I begin talking about Windows Azure, let's try and do a level set on why are customers considering cloud, right? Turns out there are three big advantages of the public cloud, and all of you are obviously deeply familiar with some of these benefits because many of you guys are using Windows Azure, and some of you perhaps are using other cloud providers as well. The first fundamental benefit of using public cloud is just the speed, right? Within minutes, you can provision computing resources compared to weeks or months that typically a big enterprise requires in order to provision resources. And what that has done is that enterprises can basically crank up the speed of innovation that they can do now with the cloud. And that makes IT really agile in meeting business needs. So that's fundamental benefit of using public cloud. A second big benefit is obviously of scale. And scale, there are two aspects to it, right? One is basically only assigning those many computing resources to your application that it demands. And the second is providing it global scale when you want. So there are two aspects of scale that the cloud gives you advantages in. And because you are able to match the supply and demand of computing resources with your application, there can be cost benefits. I'm not saying there always will be, but there can be. The other advantage of using public cloud is that it allows you to shift your capital expenditure into operating expenditure. And that's a big deal for a lot of enterprises and companies because suddenly it frees up your capital, right? And you can do other things other than investing in hardware and things like that. So those are the general advantages of using public cloud. And it's funnily enough, 2 years ago, if I were to ask customers, the big question that customers usually asked is why cloud? Today, the customers are telling us they know why cloud. They want to see how to use the cloud. So the question basically has shifted one from why to how in almost 2 years. It's a big change, right? Great. So cloud has all these advantages that brings to it. But obviously, for us IT professionals in enterprises, there are a bunch of challenges that we need to address with public cloud. And as we speak to our customers and we speak to CIOs and IT professionals and decision makers all the time, turns out, all of these challenges can be nicely bucketed into three big buckets. First one is, if you're a big enterprise, you already have a lot of investments in existing IT assets, right? Be it hardware, be it software, and you have IT staff that are managing these assets. So you might have your on-premises data centers, or you might have data centers in third-party hosters. So the big question, obviously, is how do you take all of that existing stuff and integrate with the public cloud? So integration is a big top-of-mind issue for enterprises. Less so for smaller companies or startups, because many of them today are just building into the cloud directly without any on-premises IT assets. So this is a big issue. Second big issue is that if you talk to any big enterprise, they're not just using Microsoft software, right? They're using probably a bunch of software and stuff from VMware, probably a database from Oracle. There's a bunch of open source that happens out there. So the big question obviously comes, how do I take all of this heterogeneity that I have on premises and yet use public cloud in conjunction with that? So basically a public cloud platform that is able to address the problem of heterogeneity is a big top of mind issue. And a third thing, I have never come across a customer conversation where this question was not asked, right? Security and compliance is definitely a top of mind. Because suddenly what's happening is the applications that you're running on premises in your own data centers, where you had full control on, you're now having to trust that with a public cloud vendor, right, to run your applications. So obviously security, compliance issues, that's a top of mind issue. So typically, these are the three big issues that we keep coming up against when we talk to customers about Windows Azure, about generally any sort of public cloud. So Windows Azure is designed actually with some of these fundamentals in mind, right? How do we address these problems for enterprises? And over the next few minutes, what I'll do is I'll spend some time talking about how Windows Azure is built to address some of these challenges that enterprises are facing. The first one is we talked about is integration, right? And when it comes to Microsoft or Windows Azure, we believe fundamentally in a world where public cloud is coexisting with your on-premises IT, right? Be it private cloud or just traditional hardware. And that differentiates us from some of our other competitors in the public cloud space out there. So basically, you guys might have heard this vision of Microsoft, right? We call it Cloud OS, where we see the public cloud that is provided by Microsoft coexist with your private cloud that is on-premises, or if your private cloud were to exist on a third-party hoster, right? And the reason why we're able to provide a consistent set of experiences across all these three platforms is because we have plenty of assets across virtualization, data platform, DevOps, development, and identity. If you take any of those things, for example, identity, Active Directory, Windows Server Active Directory is used by about 90% of the companies out there today. If you look at virtualization, there's Hyper-V, or data platform, there's SQL Server, with development, Visual Studio, and Management System Center, right? With all of these tools, what we're trying to do is make it easy for you to use the same set of tools, but use Windows Azure. And that's a future vision that we are, you know, driving towards in Windows Azure. Second thing I talked about is heterogeneity, right? And if you look at Windows Azure today, these are some of the different platforms and frameworks that we support. At the operating system layer, we not only provide support, obviously, for Windows Server, we also support a bunch of Linux distributions. So you can actually run Linux servers in Windows Azure. If you go up the stack, in databases, we obviously have first and best support for SQL Server. We also support Hadoop. Devices, we have support first-party SDKs for Android, iPhone, Windows, and so on. So if your developers are developing applications for any of these devices, there are SDKs for Windows Azure available. There is, if you were to think about content management frameworks out there like WordPress, Joomla, Drupal, and so on, we have support for all of that. And all of the support is out of the box, right? And languages, .NET, of course, is used by a lot of enterprises today, right, for line of business applications. But just besides .NET, there's a lot of Java out there, and more we're hearing customers use some of these modern languages like Node.js and so on. So Windows Azure provides first-party support for all of these different languages. Third thing is security, and this is obviously a top-of-mind issue. And the way we think about security is in three different facets, right? The first of which is transparency. Windows Azure, fundamentally, we believe in trust, creating trust through transparency. And when it comes to transparency, these are some of the areas where we're investing heavily in. First and foremost, we have, you know, a nice list of compliance initiatives put in place, like ISO 27001. We're also a member of Cloud Security Alliance and a bunch of industry standards. Yearly audits, we have independent third parties doing yearly audits of our platforms. When it comes to SLAs, we provide monthly SLAs as opposed to yearly SLAs that you might get elsewhere. And all of those SLAs are financially backed. So if our service were down for a little while, we actually give you cash back. Besides that, all of this information is available in a place called Trust Center Online, because we want to make sure that you have all of the information that you will need before you make those decisions on using Windows Azure or not for compliance reasons. And lastly, we have this thing called the Service Board, which tells you what is the current status of the services, the different Windows Azure services. So we're definitely big on creating this trust through transparency. The second thing is relationship. Many of you are Microsoft customers. You've been using Microsoft software for a lot of time. And with Windows Azure, we have made it easier for you to procure Windows Azure through things like enterprise agreement, for you to leverage things like Premier support. If you already have, you can get Premier support on Windows Azure. And MCS and CSS and other partners that we have are able to provide you support for Windows Azure. And these are the folks that you might already be using for your other Microsoft solutions. The last thing is on experience. I mean, a lot of folks ask us, isn't Windows Azure new? It's just a few years old, right? But the truth of the matter is we've been doing data centers since 1989, right? And over the years, we have many services that run at global scale, you know, and some of the big ones obviously are things like Hotmail, Windows Live, Bing, and so on. So Windows Azure is not really our first foray into cloud computing. And if you look at some of the other services that we have running at a global scale, these are big numbers we're talking, right? 9.9 billion messages a day via MSN Live Messenger, 200 billion plus authentication to date on the Windows Azure Active Directory that supports Office 365. And the team that manages all of these data centers is the same team that is managing Windows Azure as well, right? It's called Global Foundation Services. So all of that experience is going into building Windows Azure platform to make sure that it's running reliably and securely for you. So with that, essentially my point here was to drive home that Windows Azure, we are by design trying to address the fundamental needs that enterprises are facing, which is of integration, heterogeneity, and security. All right, so let's take a little bit of a minute or so to just look at some of the innovation that we're doing in the data centers behind Windows Azure.
Microsoft's cloud is comprised of a global...
Oops, I'm sorry for that.
Microsoft's cloud is comprised of a globally distributed data center infrastructure supporting over 200 online services, including Windows Azure, Office 365, Bing, MSN, Windows Live, Hotmail, and Xbox Live. More than a billion customers and 20 million businesses in over 70 countries use these services each year. Today, we're going to take you on a brief tour of a Microsoft data center and share how we ensure trustworthy and reliable cloud services while continuously improving performance, scalability, and efficiency. Microsoft operates a global array of data centers and edge compute nodes, all connected through a high-speed network. Our major data centers house tens of thousands of high-performance processing and storage servers in high-density racks. Chillers and air handling equipment ensure precise control over environmental conditions. Uninterruptible power supplies, or UPS systems, and vast banks of batteries help ensure power remains continuous in the event of a short-term disruption. Emergency generators provide backup power for extended outages and for planned maintenance, and can operate the data center with on-site fuel reserves in the event of a natural disaster. A high-speed, robust fiber optic network connects servers within the data center and connects each data center with other major hubs and internet users. Edge compute nodes host workloads closer to the end users to reduce latency and increase overall service resiliency. Microsoft ensures high availability through multiple layers of redundancy, advanced monitoring and incident response, and geo-redundant backup and graceful failover capability, all managed through our geographically distributed Microsoft Operations Centers, operating 24/7, 365 days a year. We also deploy one of the largest implementations of Microsoft System Center in the world, and we use our own.
So hopefully that gave you a glimpse of, you know, how the Microsoft data centers are run. And these are the same data centers where Windows Azure runs as well. So with that, let's start talking about what comprises the Windows Azure platform. First thing is the data centers like we just talked about, right? Windows Azure today runs in 8 different regions. And we recently announced 2 regions being available in China. We also announced our plans to unveil 2 regions in Japan and 2 regions in Australia as well. right? And of the 8 regions that are running today, there are 4 in US, 2 in Europe, and 2 in Asia. And the ones in Europe are located in Ireland and in Netherlands. So beyond these, well, these are some of the pictures of the data centers, and I'm told each of these data centers are about 7 to 10 times the size of an average football field. So they're pretty big facilities. And the first picture that you see there is what a container, we call it an IT pack or a pre-assembled container unit. They look like shipment containers that are dropped in these data centers. And if there was a problem or whatever with any of these, the entire container is shipped out and a new container is replaced. So that's that basically gives efficiency and scale in managing these data centers. So beyond the data centers, like we talked about earlier, we do provide global support all across the world. There are local account teams for you to obviously reach out to if there were issues or in terms of procurement and all the way to support. And there are local currencies that we support. There are 19 local currencies that we support today if you were to transact for Windows Azure. So this just gives you a glimpse of the global presence for Windows Azure. And if global scale is one of the reasons that you want to consider the cloud for, Windows Azure becomes a really good bet for you. All right. So we talked about the data centers. What is the stack? What does the Windows Azure stack look like? So you can, the easiest way of thinking about Windows Azure is a bunch of services. There are about 24 services that comprise the Windows Azure stack today. And the nice way of thinking about these services is thinking about them like building blocks across these 3 categories. At the bottom, we have what are known as infrastructure services, or the fundamental building blocks to start building your applications. Above that, it's data services. These are the services that give you basically things like storage, database, and so on. Above that, there are a lot of application services that make for easy building of applications on Windows Azure, right? So just a nice way of thinking about the platform. What can you do with Windows Azure now? The 2 different things you can do. First, you can use some of these services and build applications, right? Fairly straightforward. In this case, we've just taken a few of those building blocks, and you build an application. Windows Azure then can basically take that application, run that application, manage that application, and scale it as necessary. If you're thinking of using Windows Azure in that fashion, you are basically doing what the industry pundits would call PaaS, or platform as a service, right? Essentially, you're responsible for the application, and the platform does the rest for you. Now, there's another way of using Windows Azure, which is basically what the industry pundits call infrastructure as a service, or IaaS. So you can do this by using some of the bottom layer building blocks in the infrastructure services bucket. Essentially, what that allows you to do is mimic some sort of building a data center in the public cloud just the way you would do on premises. So with this, what you can do is, you know, spin up virtual machines. You can assign private IP addresses, bring in your own DNS, and optionally connect it back to your on-premises using a VPN. Right? So if you were to use Windows Azure in that fashion, you're basically doing infrastructure as a service. And as a platform, we offer both these options for you. And some customers I've seen have leveraged the fact that we provide both these options to build some really sophisticated application models where part of the application, perhaps the web tier, is, you know, using PaaS. The database tier, perhaps, is using infrastructure as a service, basically SQL Server running inside of a VM. Right? So it provides you a lot of options to build and craft your applications. And the neat thing about infrastructure as a service is it allows you also to run applications that you're using already on-premises, because in on-premises world, it's all infrastructure as services, right? You are running applications inside of a VM, you're managing the VM, and you're responsible for all of the application, from all the way from managing the application to scaling the application. So with that, what I want to do is, you know, show you guys the Windows Azure Management Console. Some of you already are using Windows Azure, so you're, you know, intimately familiar with it. But hopefully the rest of you can actually see what it feels like to manage the Windows Azure Console and see some of these services come to life. So let me switch to my computer. All right, so here, I am in the Windows Azure portal. The URL is manage.windowsazure.com. And what I will first try and do is log in. And there are two ways you can log into your Windows Azure management portal. One is using your Live ID, if it's set up that way. And the second way is using Windows Azure Active Directory, which is basically the same identity provider as is used by Office 365. If you were to do the latter, what you can do is enable two-factor authentication on your account. So what we'll try and do is, you know, use the latter and log into the Windows Azure Management portal via the two-factor authentication, which we call active authentication. So I'm going to go ahead and sign in. Okay, I know the problem. The problem is that I'm trying to use my organizational ID on Live ID site. So I have to click on the organizational account first, and then I log in. Now, essentially, what the portal is trying to do is it will try and place a call to me to verify that, you know, I not only have the password, which is required, obviously, to log in. The second factor is that I have the actual device, which is basically the phone with which I'm registering. And typically, this takes a few seconds for the call to come in. So I've got the call now. I'm going to answer it, put it on speaker so you guys can hear. Okay, there's a lot of noise out here because of the tech equipment. But essentially, what I need to do is press the pound key when the call comes in. And once I press the pound key, it will log me into the system. So now, essentially, we're logged into the system using active authentication. It required me to enter my password, and also it gave me a call. Now, there are a couple of other options as well. Instead of, you know, using a call, there's an application that you can download from the store and use that app as well if you want that to be the second factor instead of you receiving a call. All right, so this is what the Windows Azure Management Portal looks like. On the left-hand side, what you see is all the different services that are running, computing resources and services that are running in your Windows Azure subscription. And bottom here is what you see is what I call a launcher. Essentially, that is the place you want to go if you want to launch anything new, a new service or a new computing resource, right? And the portal is an HTML5 portal, so it will work from any device that supports HTML5, any browser that supports HTML5. So with that, let's go back and now take a look at some of the scenarios to use Windows Azure in your enterprise. So far, what we did is talk about, you know, some of the benefits of using Windows Azure, some of the design principles, and what the stack looks like in terms of the different services. Now we'll switch gears slightly and talk about some of the scenarios where you can start using Windows Azure in your enterprises. And we're going to cover basically four scenarios, the first of which is using Windows Azure for storage, backup, and recovery. Second one is using Windows Azure for test and development. Third one is fairly sophisticated. That's essentially a scenario of extending your existing data center to Windows Azure and use Windows Azure as a virtual data center. And the last scenario is we call it reach where your data center won't. Essentially, it's a scenario where you use Windows Azure natively without much of on-premises assets, because there are some things that Windows Azure does really well, and you wouldn't want to use your on-premises existing data center or computing capacity to serve those applications. So let's start talking about the first scenario, which is basically storage backup and recovery. When you're thinking about storage backup and recovery, you know, why would you want to use the cloud in general for storage backup and recovery? Turns out if you ask organizations what's happening with their data needs every year, this is what they tell us, that their data is increasing exponentially. In fact, that's an IDC figure, 50 to 60% growth year over year in a typical enterprise in the amount of data that they capture and keep, right? But if you peel the onion back and ask how much of this data is actually frequently accessed, this is what the line starts looking like. Basically, most of the data is not really, you know, frequently accessed, but you still need to keep that for archiving purposes, right? So an idea is, why not use the frequently accessed data, which is also called working set data, on your premises, and the rest in the cloud? Obviously, there's an economic reason for that, and that is that on-premises, you know, cost of storing data in your own data center is much more expensive. And Forrester had this stat 2 years ago where they compared the cost of using public cloud for storage and on-premises SAN storage. And turns out one is 4 times as expensive as the other. On-premises, it is expensive to use for storage compared to the public cloud. Why? Because, you know, there's a lot of overhead costs, there are management costs, not just the actual cost of the storage itself, right? But does that mean that all the data that you don't need on-premises, you can put it up in the cloud? Obviously not, because, you know, you might have performance reasons, you might have compliance reasons, you know, because of which you cannot keep some data in the cloud. But this is a nice way of starting to think about what kinds of data you can keep in public cloud versus keep it on-premises. So with that, let's talk a little bit about the Windows Azure storage system. When I think about the Windows Azure storage system, I just think of the cloud and a big, beautiful hard drive in there, right? Just a giant hard drive. The neat thing about this giant hard drive is that it holds about 7 trillion objects today across the globe. Last year, it held about 4 trillion objects. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of growth when it comes to enterprises in using the Windows Azure storage. And recently, Nasuni, an independent third party, you know, they ranked Azure storage system as the topmost storage out there when it comes to all the public cloud vendors. And this was based on a bunch of metrics like performance, availability, and so on, that they performed tests over a period of a month before giving us the ranking. Now, let's talk about some of the features of the storage system that we have in place in Windows Azure. Obviously, it's highly durable and scalable. And we make multiple copies of every single piece of data that you were to store in Windows Azure. So what we do is, if you keep a file or an object or whatever, we make 3 copies of that within a region, right? Basically, that is to make sure that your data is continuously accessible. So if a server or a storage rack were to go down, you still have access to your data. It provides for availability and durability. We also provide financially backed SLAs for the storage system. Today, the SLA is 99.9%. And it's financially backed. And the fundamental storage system that we have in Windows Azure is the same storage system, whether you were to use it to store objects or tables, which is basically structured data, or use drives for the virtual machines. The underlying storage system is the same storage system. So whether it's a drive that's, you know, spun up within a VM, that's attached to a VM, or if it's a file, we make 3 copies of that at least within a single region. And we support REST APIs. They're all public open REST APIs for using the Windows Azure storage system. It's a nice animation. The other neat feature about the Windows Azure storage system is that not only do we keep 3 copies in a region of your choice, we also keep another extra 3 copies in a region that's far away, hundreds of miles away. And the reason for doing that is so that you are protected against regional disasters. And we call this feature geo-replication. So if you are thinking about using Windows Azure storage in scenarios like DR planning for your data and so on, this becomes a very neat feature for you to rely on to use, you know, so that if you were to protect your data against regional disasters, you want to enable this feature called geo-replication. So with that, what I want to do is switch back to my console and show you the workflow of creating a storage account, copying a simple file into the Windows Azure storage system, and show some of the, as we go through the workflow, some of the features where you can select your application and so on. So let's switch back to the console. So before you actually start using the Windows Azure storage system, the first thing you want to do is create a storage account. And you do that by basically going to New here, under Data Services, Storage, Quick Create. It will obviously require a URL. This is a public endpoint with which you will access the storage account from here on. So I'm going to choose something that is unique, because that's a requirement. OK, that is taken by me, I think. So I'm going to go ahead and create. Here, it allows you to select the region where you want to have the storage account. So if you're in Europe, and you don't want your data to leave Europe, you will want to choose one of the European data centers or regions, right? So North or West Europe. So I'm going to go ahead and select North Europe here. And this is the feature which I explained earlier called geo-replication. If you leave this feature on, what happens is every single piece of data that you put in North Europe is asynchronously copied into the other region in Europe as well, West Europe. That happens in the background. So there is, of course, a lag in terms of integrity of your data between the two different regions. But at least, you know, you do have a secondary offsite backup for the primary region that you select. Of course, you can always uncheck this option if you don't want this feature. And there is a discount that we provide in terms of the pricing. So I'll leave this option on here. So, and this basically starts creating a storage account. It takes a few seconds to create the storage account. And meanwhile, what we'll do is we'll go into one of the existing accounts that I created and look at, you know, some of the stuff that you can do. So here is here I have a storage account I've created already. This is a view. It gives you a nice dashboard. You can enable monitoring if you want to on the account. And a quick glance here shows you that, you know, there is geo-replication enabled. When was the last geo-replication failover that happened? Basically, that's to say, when did the last disaster happen, if it happened at all, and where the secondary region is. The next thing I want to show is, point your attention is to this thing called manage access keys. So for every storage account that you create, we provide two access keys. And these are the keys with which you will access that storage account to put data or to read back data. And the reason why we provide two storage access keys is so that in case one you were regenerating for whatever reason, you still have access to the storage account. Okay, it's taking a little time to show you the keys, but essentially once it finishes loading, there you go. It's basically showing a primary key and a secondary key with which you can access the storage account. The second thing we want to take a look at is this thing called the containers here. And what containers are, they're basically abstract concepts, and I think of them as just like folders inside of a drive. Before you start putting files into the storage account, you have to create a container. So let's go ahead and create a container here, and we'll call it financial data, because later on I want to copy some financial Excel sheet into this container. The access, again, you have options. Do you want it to be a public container so that everybody can access it, or you want it to be private? So only folks who have the access key can access this container. So I'm going to leave it to private and go ahead and create that container. All right, so the container is basically created. The next thing what we'll do is try and copy a file into that container we just created. And in order to do so, I'll use a third-party tool called CloudBerry Explorer, and that is built against the Windows Azure REST APIs to talk to the Windows Azure storage system. I'm using the free version of the tool. You can download online. And here, essentially, there are a couple of steps that you need to do in order to associate the storage account that you created with the tool. So what I've done is I've already associated the Windows Azure storage account with the tool. And if you're curious how to get that done, what you can do is click here. It's a very simple setup where you essentially enter the name of the storage account, and you put the key that, you know, the one of the two keys that you actually showed just now. And once that is set up, this tool basically can see the storage account that you set up, and you can list all the containers that are inside there. Now, this is a container that we just created in the storage account. I'm going to go in and copy a file over. It's an empty container right now. There we go. So the file is now copied into that container. And if I go and actually see the container here, it will actually list all the different files inside the container. Right? So this is basically a simple way, very simple way of using the Windows Azure storage system without having to write any code whatsoever, right? And what happened, obviously, is three copies of that file were made within the region, and asynchronously in the background, another three copies will be made of that file in a faraway region. So that file is a really important file because it's backed up like six times. Okay, so let's switch back and talk about some fairly sophisticated ways of using Windows Azure Storage System. What I showed was obviously a very simple way of using Windows Azure Storage System, right? So I'll talk about three things where you can start using the storage system in enterprises. The first one is called StorSimple. Now, StorSimple is a device that you put on your premises that essentially acts like a SAN-based storage solution. It uses iSCSI to connect to your virtual servers or physical servers, and appears, you know, just like a drive, an iSCSI drive, like in the picture. What it does, however, is that it is automatically tiering data. All the data that you're copying into that device, it is segregating data into stuff that is accessed frequently and data that is not accessed frequently. And the frequently accessed data, it is keeping on premises. It's got, you know, SSD as well as hard drives on the device. And the other infrequently accessed data, it is silently backing up to Windows Azure. And when it backs it up to Windows Azure, it does things like encryption, deduplication, and compression, so that, you know, your network costs are not high and the actual storage that you're using in Windows Azure is not that much either, right? So it's a neat way of starting to use the Windows Azure storage for backup and recovery using a device like this. Obviously, you know, we've seen customers save a lot of, you know, have a lot, derive a lot of economic benefit of using Storage Simple. And we've seen, you know, TCOs go down by as much as 60 to 80% when they replaced existing SAN-based solutions with Store Simple. So this is one way of using Windows Azure Storage. Now, second way of using Windows Azure Storage is basically to back up your SQL Server databases, because databases tend to get very big in size. You can use SQL Server, SQL Server Management Studio to back up, you know, your SQL Server databases into the Windows Azure system. And the other unique benefit of doing that is if your on-premises database server were to go down, because your backups are already up in the cloud, you can now spin up virtual machines in Windows Azure with those backups, and you actually have a database server running up pretty quickly, right? So you can factor that into your DR planning as you think about using Windows Azure for storage and backup. Yet a third way of using Windows Azure storage is through the service called Windows Azure Backup, right, which is in preview right now. What Windows Azure Backup does is it lets you backup files and folders from your Windows server or, you know, entire VMs from your System Center DPM up into Windows Azure. And the way you would do that is I'll show you in a little bit what the workflow of that looks like. But the benefit of using Windows Azure Backup is that it is integrated with System Center DPM and Windows Server. So for things like your folders or files in Windows Server that you want to back up to the cloud, this is a very neat and easy way to set that up. So let's switch back to the console and take you through some of the stuff, some of the steps that you will need in order to start using Windows Azure Backup. Now, the first thing you want to do is actually go to the launcher and create a backup vault. And that option is here in Recovery Services. We'll choose Quick Create here. It'll ask me for name of the backup vault, and I'm going to call it Backup Vault 123. Again, it gives me a choice of regions. The reason why you don't see all the regions here is because it's a preview service. It's only available in three regions right now. I'm going to choose West Europe and create the vault. It is creating the backup vault. Meanwhile, well, it's completed. After the backup vault is created, there are a few steps that you need to do in order to use Windows Azure Backup. The first is you have to upload your public certificate, because the entire management is certificate-based, right? So you have to upload a management cert. The second thing you want to do is download an agent, because an agent is required to configure your server. And once that agent is installed, you have to go through a registration process, during which it will ask you for your private key or the PFX file that you will need to configure so as to connect to the server backup. And the last thing is basically to do your backups. So here, what I've done is I've set up a backup already that is connected to a server which I'm using Windows Azure Backup with. So let's go and take a look at that server, what that looks like. I'm going to RDP into that server. As you can see, the server is actually running in Windows Azure also. So So once you install the agent, this is the agent, it's an icon here. And once you double-click, you basically get this view. First thing you want to do is register the server by clicking on the right-hand side. As you go through the registration process, it asks you a few steps. Make sure that you have the necessary private key in order to connect to the backup vault that we just created. And once all of that is finished, you can then start creating backups, right? And the way you can schedule backups is by clicking the second option here, which essentially is another wizard that you... It's a fairly common workflow that you're probably already used to if you're using a Windows server. And in this case, what I've done is I've already created a backup. I've scheduled a backup that basically backs up the D drive of the server to Windows Azure. And if you see, if you go back to the console and click on the servers, it gives you a bunch of information on what are the servers that are backing up to this backup vault. In this case, this is the Win server, which is the name of the server that you guys just saw. The items that are being protected by the service, which is essentially the D drive that I configured earlier on, and so on and so forth. So essentially, it's a very straightforward way of using Windows Azure storage for just backups. And in case, of course, recovery is needed, that's also possible through the service. So switching back, essentially what we did is we took a look at a few ways in which you can start using the Windows Azure storage. All of them are fairly straightforward ways. There is no real code to be written, and they're almost drop-in ways of using the storage system in Windows Azure. Now let's take a look at the second scenario, which is fairly common among enterprises, which is using Windows Azure for test and development purposes. If you were to look at on-premises environments today, there are a bunch of issues, you know, when it comes to using your data centers for test and dev. You know, we hear these all the time from customers. You know, there's limited hardware budget, or there's limited software licenses to give to developers for dev and test. Or there is resource contention, because in typical enterprises, the LOB applications are the tier one applications, and the test and dev work usually is tier two. So prioritization is just not given to the test and dev work sometimes. And all of these basically result in, you know, compromising agility of your developers when it comes to test and dev. And the last reason, you know, sometimes you want to think about the public cloud and Windows Azure for dev and test is because you simply cannot do realistic scale tests on premise. For example, if there is an application that requires 1,000 VMs during peak times, but actually only requires 100 VMs during base times, there is no way you can actually just have another 900 VMs sitting by for testing that application. Things like those become a very good use case for using Windows Azure, because in Windows Azure, you can spin up VMs as you want and spin them down when you're finished with them, right? And you're only paying for the time that you actually used. So obviously, when you use Windows Azure, all of those issues with using on-premises environments for test and dev go away. Additionally, there are a bunch of things that we announced this month that make for even better test and dev use case in Windows Azure. The first of which is we announced what's known as permanent billing. So essentially what that means is if you were running a Windows Azure VM for, let's say, 13 minutes, you're only charged for 13 minutes versus rounding it off to 1 hour, right, which used to be the case. And the other thing is we've also extended the MSDN benefits. So if you have MSDN subscriptions, you actually get all the way up to about $150 in MSDN benefits to start using Windows Azure for test and dev type scenarios. And the rest of the things we already talked about, all of these basically provide developer agility. So another neat thing about using Windows Azure for test and dev is that the underlying VM image that we use in Windows Azure is actually based on Hyper-V. So it is the same VHD format that you run on-premises. So a lot of customers, when they ask questions like, great, I can use test and dev in Windows Azure, but I want to run my application on-premises, how do I do that? Well, you do it this way, because the underlying VHD is the same format. So Windows Azure basically runs Hyper-V VHDs if they're 64-bit VHDs, and once you finish test and dev in Windows Azure, you can bring them back on-premises as well. So let's switch back to the console, and I'll show you the workflow of spinning up a VM, what that looks like, and as we go along, I'll explain some of the features of virtual machines as well. So in order to spin up a VM, it's a fairly straightforward process. Go to New, hit Compute, a virtual machine, and we'll choose a gallery. There's a quick create option. If you know exactly what you're doing, you can choose that option. I'll choose a gallery. It gives you more options. And we have a gallery of images that you can choose your VM from. to start running. So there's SQL Server, there's SharePoint 2012, Windows Server 2008. There are a bunch of Linux distributions out there as well. So what I will do is I will just choose the stock Windows Server 2012 Data Center Edition here and click on Next. It's going to ask me a name for the machine. And then it's going to give me the option of the size of the machine. So this is basically the number of cores that are assigned to that virtual machine. So we go all the way from extra small, which is 768 megabytes, all the way to 8 cores and 56 GB of memory. So depending on your application type, you can choose any of these options. So I'm going to go ahead and choose small, fill in the username with which I will be logging in. And create next. Now, this option is basically, you know, asking me, do I want this VM to connect to another VM? So if you have a bunch of VMs and you want to connect all of them, and we'll look at that in a little bit, but here I'll just choose the standalone VM option. The DNS name is basically a publicly facing canonical name that with which you will access the virtual machine. It has to be unique. So I'm going to try if this is not taken. Wonderful. And I can associate a storage account with this VM. I'm going to leave the default. I'm going to select in region. Again, I want it to be running out of the West Europe data center. Click Next. Availability set is a concept. Essentially, if you want a bunch of VMs and you are running an application such that all of these VMs are residing on different fault domains, you have to choose that option called availability set. So Windows Azure knows that when machines are placed in an availability set, it will make sure that when things are updating, platform is updating or whatnot, it does not bring all of those servers down together. So it's going to make sure that the other server is still running while one of the servers is being patched, right? So that's the concept called availability set. And boom, it's done. So it's going to go ahead and provision. It takes roughly 2 to 5 minutes to provision a VM. And once the VM is actually provisioned, what you can do is just, you know, it's just a VM running up in the cloud. You can RDP into it. It's your basic plain Windows Server VM that you're going to get, right? From that point onwards, you are responsible for patching and managing the actual guest operating system, right? Because you're using now Windows Azure in what's known as infrastructure as a services mode. So we don't actually patch the system and so on and so forth. When the patching that I was talking about earlier is the virtualization layer or the host OS, right? Not the guest OS. Okay, so we'll switch back. And what I wanted to do is just give you an example of a customer who recently used Windows Azure for, you know, their test and dev and creating a test and dev environment in Windows Azure. And after they were done, they basically took the entire application and ported it over to a third-party hosting provider. So the customer in this case is Telenor. Many of you guys have obviously heard of them. A big Norwegian company with a lot of business units spread all over. And what they wanted to do was upgrade their SharePoint 2007 to SharePoint 2013. That's a typo there. There's no 2013 yet. And the way they did it was by, you know, spinning up a bunch of farms in Windows Azure. So on the left-hand side, what you see is all the different farms that they had in Windows Azure. And within weeks, they were able to finish all the dev and test environment and then shift all of the SharePoint over to the hosting partner, right? And they did that using PowerShell tooling, obviously. And they were able to basically get all of the benefits that I talked about with test and dev earlier. Improved agility. Imagine if they had to actually do it on premises, right? Some 80 to 100 VMs, provisioning all of them, and then spinning them up, doing dev and test, and then finally moving it to, say, a third-party provider. It would have taken them a lot more time than it actually did. So this is an example where customers were able to see benefits by using Windows Azure for test and dev. Now, the third scenario we're going to talk about is extending your infrastructure. And this is a fairly sophisticated scenario for using Windows Azure. In this scenario, essentially, what you'll be seeing is how to use Windows Azure as almost like a virtual data center running out there. You get a lot more control on your VMs, on your actual network, and so on. And the way you would do that is by using the service called Windows Azure Virtual Network. What that service does, it provides you a logical isolation and control over the actual network itself. And within the network that you then create, you get control of bringing your own DNS. You get control of bringing your own IP addresses, your private IP addresses, right? And once you're able to do this, what you can then do is optionally connect it back to on-premises or a different site altogether using a VPN IPsec tunnel. Obviously, once you have this whole setup done, you know, you can do a lot of things, right? You can do things like domain join. If you have an Active Directory running in your own data center and you have a bunch of VMs running in Windows Azure, not only do they get private IP addresses, you can also domain join them. And once you domain join, the possibilities are limitless. You can run, for example, SharePoint up there, which is in the same, which is sharing identity with your on-premises environment and so on. In a little bit, we'll go through the workflow of creating something like a virtual network in Windows Azure. The next thing that we announced recently, and this is a very new feature, is called point-to-site VPN. Earlier, what I showed is called site-to-site VPN. So in a site-to-site VPN configuration, you can build an IPsec tunnel between an entire site on-premises with a virtual network that you have in Windows Azure. With point-to-site, you're basically connecting individual devices or servers up to the virtual network in Windows Azure by using the VPN client that's already baked into the Windows operating system, the client operating system. And this is a rather unique scenario because, you know, in the site-to-site option, you actually require to set up a VPN gateway on-premises. Or if you already have a VPN gateway like a Cisco device or a Juniper device, you can always configure it to connect to virtual network in Windows Azure. But what if you just wanted one server to connect up to Windows Azure in a secure fashion? That's when you would use point-to-site. And the neat thing about point-to-site is that it can traverse firewalls and proxies, so you don't have to adjust your corporate firewall to make an exception for that server just because you want to connect that server to Windows Azure in a secure fashion. So again, this is a neat test and dev. It enables test and dev scenarios. Or if you have a developer who is sitting in an airport cafe and wants to connect up to Windows Azure in a secure fashion, and you know, and you don't want them to use RDP because RDP is an open public port, you can use this feature again for those sort of scenarios. So this is an example that we'll go through of setting up a virtual network in Windows Azure. What you see on the right-hand side is the Windows Azure Virtual Network environment, and what you see on the left-hand side is perhaps your office environment. On the left-hand side, it's a 10.1 network. In Windows Azure, it's a 10.10 network. Both are, you know, private IP address ranges. So the first step that we'll go through is create the right-hand side virtual network in Windows Azure with those settings. And what then is required is obviously to spin up a gateway so that you can make a connection back to on-premises office network, or to even connect individual machines using point-to-site connectivity that we just talked about. So what we'll do is obviously we'll create the demo VNet, and then we'll try and connect a machine that's running here over to the virtual network in Windows Azure, and I'll explain some of the steps that you need to take care of as we go through that workflow. What we will not do is what you see on the left-hand side, which is basically setting up the VPN gateway on-premises, configuring that to connect to the virtual network. Right? But I'll also explain some of the steps you can do that easily as you go through the workflow. So switching back to the console here again, the way you would create a virtual network in Windows Azure is, again, going and hitting New, hitting the Networks tab here, and Virtual Network. There are a bunch of ways you can create a virtual network. If you already have an XML file and you want to just import the configuration, you can do so by importing configuration. Or you can do other things. But what we'll do is we'll go and do the long approach, which is custom create, because that gives you all of the options required to create a virtual network. First thing it's going to ask me is the name of the virtual network. I'm going to go give it demo VNet 123. It's going to ask me what's known as an affinity group. Essentially, an affinity group is a construct. If you were to place machines inside of an affinity group, then Windows Azure basically places them very close together. Perhaps even on the same rack, so as to minimize network latencies between those machines. Affinity basically means attraction, and that's the way I remember it, right? It's making sure that VMs are co-located, if possible, even within the same rack. Every virtual network is by default associated with an affinity group. It's a requirement, mandatory requirement. So in this case, we'll just go ahead and create a new affinity group. I'm going to call it demo VNet. There's a typo in there. So here is the option for, you know, and this is an optional step, by the way. You can bring in your own DNS. If you have a DNS server running on-premises, a private DNS server, you can use that in Windows Azure as well. So what I've done is I've pre-created a DNS server, and I'm going to use 10.1.0.4 for this particular VNet that we're going to create in Windows Azure. And if I wanted additional DNS servers, this is the place where I actually configure. And the neat thing, what you can see below, is the network preview. As you are going through the wizard and taking, going forward with all the different steps, it actually gives you a nice preview of what your network starts looking like. I'm going to configure it for point-to-site VPN as well as a site-to-site VPN. And my local network, now this is the network that is supposed to be on-premises. So in this case, I'm going to just go ahead and choose my office, which is a pre-created local network with the IP address range that I just showed in the slide. And go ahead. On this screen, what it's asking me is the IP address range, and so that the IP addresses can be assigned to the individual machines that are connected to the virtual network through the point-to-site feature. So I'm going to leave it default. It's the 10.0.0.0 range. And later on, you will see that when I have this machine connecting to the Windows Azure virtual network, I will be assigned an IP address from this range automatically by Windows Azure Gateway. And now this is the address range for the virtual network that we're going to create in Windows Azure. Earlier, if you remember, it was a 10.10 network I wanted to create in Windows Azure. So I have to configure that here. I get to choose how many machines I want. I'm going to choose 16/16 here. And then optionally, I can create a bunch of subnets underneath. So if I want, for example, two subnets in there, I'm going to call it front-end subnet and back-end subnet. I can splice it the way I'd like. So I'm going to go ahead and choose this. I'm going to call this back-end subnet. So I've created two subnets in my virtual network. Now what I need to do is an additional step, and I need to add a gateway subnet. So that's a separate subnet that needs to be created for the gateway servers to be running. Because if you remember earlier, I mentioned that we need to, if you want to connect it to that virtual network, a VPN gateway has to be set up in Windows Azure. So because we spin up two gateways, you need to have a subnet for the gateway subnet. So once that step is done, I'm going to go ahead and select OK. Now it's in the process of provisioning that virtual network that we just created. So while that is getting created, I want to take you to an existing virtual network I just created beforehand and show you some of the, you know, on the dashboard and certificates and things like that. So in this case, what you can see is the demo VNet is set up, but I don't have my office network yet connected to this virtual network. Once I finish that configuration step, which is essentially configure the Cisco, the Juniper device that is sitting in my office, this connection will show as it's established, which we're not going to do now. What we will try and do is connect a client machine, which is my machine here, to this particular virtual network. And in order to do that, there are a few steps I need to take. The first step is basically to upload a management certificate. It's a self-signed root certificate that needs to be uploaded. And the way you would do that is going to the Certificates tab and uploading your self-signed root certificate. In this case, I'm not going to upload right now, but I have already uploaded one before, and the certificate basically sits here. Now, the second step I need to do is the private key file, which is a PFX file, needs to be installed on this client machine before this can connect to the virtual network. And obviously, that PFX is signed by the root cert that I just uploaded for into the virtual network. So in this case, I have the PFX. I'm going to import it into the local certificate repository. It's protected by a password. OK. So that step is done. Once that is done, the next step I need to do is download a device configuration script from this portal. That is in the dashboard of the demo VNet. There are a few options depending on the type of client machine that you connect to. This is a 64-bit machine, so I'm going to download that. So essentially what that does is it configures my local machine to be able to connect the demo VNet that we just created. Okay, let's go ahead and run that script. Done. Now if we go and see the network options here, what you see is an additional option called demo VNet, right? And that got created as we just ran that script that you just saw. Let's go ahead and connect to that demo VNet now. It's connected. If you were to now look at, you know, the network status and we want to look at the IP address, as you can see, it's gotten a 10.0.0.5 IP address, right? Which is in the range that we earlier mentioned. We wanted the client machines to be in the 10.0.0.0 address range. From here on, basically, this machine here that I have is on the same IP address range as the virtual network. Now, what I've done is I've spun up a virtual machine. If you remember the workflow for creating a virtual machine, there is a step where it asks you, do you want it to be placed into a virtual network? That's how you would spin up VMs inside of a virtual network that you create. So what I've done is I've gone ahead and spun up a virtual machine in the demo VNet. It's called COP file server. It's gotten this particular IP address, 10.10.0.4. And what we'll try and do now is connect to this VM from my virtual machine, from my, sorry, demo PC here. So I'm going to copy that IP address. And try and access a folder in that particular server. Okay, somehow looks like the connection got dropped. So I'm going to try that again. Okay, that is supposed to work anyways. But you get the picture. What we're trying to do is access a VM that's running inside of the virtual network from my machine. And once you're able to basically connect this machine using the point-to-site feature, you can just treat it like your office network, right? And you can use it for your file servers or anything that you wish. And there's a secure connectivity in place between this machine and that. And we use SSTP to do that. All right. So let's switch back and talk about the last scenario. Which is basically ways in which you can use Windows Azure for unique things that your on-premises data center might not suffice those needs. First one is, you know, just using it for websites. You know, a lot of customers usually ask us, if you want to, for example, spin up your marketing site, right, or a marketing campaign, one way of doing it is basically on your premises using a bunch of VMs or machines, setting up your IIS and so on and so forth. With Windows Azure, what we've done is we've made that much, very, very easy. if you have, let's say, a WordPress site or a Joomla site or whatever, we have a gallery of images that you can just choose and spin up websites very, very quickly. And once that website is set up, you can also use this service called Traffic Manager. What Traffic Manager does is it basically provides for high performance or high availability of a website. So if you have websites running in Europe as well as in Asia, if your customers are going to the website from Asia, they get served out of the Asian data center versus the European data center. So that makes for things like marketing campaigns or corporate websites very easy to actually get set up and done. So let's go back to the console, and I'll show you a couple of features in the website's menu to see how you can actually scale your website once you have that set up and going. So I'm going to go ahead and cancel this. And the way you would basically spin up a simple website, right, is by going to Compute again and click on Website. You can choose a variety of things from the gallery. Today, the gallery is really rich with lots of frameworks, pre-built frameworks for you to choose from. So, for example, if you have a .NET CMS-based website, you can choose that as an option. If you want a blog using WordPress, you can choose that as an option, or Drupal, and so on and so forth. So what I'll do is I'll just choose WordPress, and we'll just create a simple blog using the WordPress. So I go ahead and choose this, click Next. It's going to ask me for, again, the URL. TechEdure123 seems to exist. The region from which it will be served, I'm going to choose North Europe here. The database it will use, in this case, it's a SQL database that's pre-set up. It's a MySQL database, which we're partnering with ClearDB. And click OK. And the website basically gets set up. So it's as simple as that. A few clicks, and you're actually up and running with a blog site. That's what websites as a service actually does. Now, that's obviously easy if you want to just simply have a simple website. What if you were experiencing a lot of traffic to your website, though? You need to scale that website, and you want to probably have dedicated instances running that website. And that's what we'll take a look on how to do. So if you look into websites here, I have an existing website that's running. It's also a WordPress blog site. There are a few options here if you go under scale. Currently, it's using the free tier, right? We don't charge you if you use the free tier. But if you see the traffic to that website go up, you can choose what's known as shared or reserved. Both free and shared tiers are actually using multi-tenant servers, so you're sharing the server with somebody else. But if you want your own reserved instances, you can do that by choosing the reserved option here. And once you choose the reserved option, you also get the choice of increasing the instances that are running that website. So if you're building the next Facebook or Twitter or whatever, obviously, you want the instance count to be way high rather than just one instance. And you do that by simply dragging that bar here. So fairly a simple way of creating simple things like websites and then scaling it, right? So that was the first scenario in here, basically using Windows Azure for building websites. Now, a second scenario of using Windows Azure is to use it for mobile applications, which we've seen is a fairly common scenario these days with mobile devices being used in enterprises. Enterprises are asking, what is the best place where I can put the backend for those mobile applications, right? Because every mobile app that is running on a device requires maybe a database, maybe requires computing power and so on, right, up in the cloud. So what we've done is we're providing a turnkey service called Windows Azure Mobile Services that provides structured data, that provides database, that provides compute power on which an application that's running on a device can actually rely on to speed up application development. So with Windows Azure mobile devices, if you're an enterprise, obviously you can use it to build mobile applications for your existing enterprise applications. You can also use it for customer-facing applications that run on devices. And we have SDKs today for Android. We have for Windows Phone, as well as iOS, first-party SDKs with which you can develop those applications and have the backend and the compute power reside in Windows Azure. So that's a fairly common scenario we're seeing customers use Windows Azure for as well. A third scenario, and this is fairly sophisticated, is if you are an enterprise and you have a bunch of systems, right, IT systems already, that you want to integrate perhaps with your partners. Windows Azure becomes a rather unique place for you to meet those systems, right? Marry those systems. So for example, if you have a supplier and you want to connect their system with your own system, but you don't want to poke your endpoints into your firewall to make that happen, you can use the Windows Azure messaging bus is a service that we have in place for you to connect those systems up. Right? And recently what we announced is BizTalk Services. So if you're familiar with BizTalk Server, BizTalk Services essentially is providing some of those features that BizTalk Server does, but in a PaaS form. So you can use those services to connect systems as well. And today we have the EAI type capabilities, EDI capabilities as well with BizTalk Services. And so for things like Oracle systems or SAP systems, Windows Azure becomes a good backbone to connect different disparate IT systems across partners. So that was basically a third scenario where you can start thinking about using Windows Azure, where you would traditionally not use your on-premises data center or a third-party hoster. So with that, basically what I've done is, hopefully is, gone over Windows Azure, an introduction to Windows Azure, and some of the scenarios where you can use Windows Azure in your enterprise. And as we went through the different workflows, hopefully you have now a little more knowledge on the different things that you need to go through, different steps that you need to take to start using Windows Azure. So at this point, we have like 5 minutes. I'm happy to take questions. Other than the pronunciation of Windows Azure. Yes, sir. Sorry, I cannot hear you. Are there mics or no mics? Okay. So if I heard correctly, the question is, does Windows Azure run on a client? No.
Just the backup service.
OK.
Does it run on Windows 8, for example? Or if not, mm-hmm. are there any plans on that direction?
Sure, that's a great question. I get that often. So currently, no. It's in preview. Currently, it's only on Windows Server 2012, I think 2008 R2. And some of the flavors of the server as well, but it's not yet built for a client yet. Yeah, but yeah, we hear that, and yeah, that's definitely something to look forward to. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead. Say that again. When we will support multiple site-to-site VPN. So today what you can do is you can have, if you have multiple sites, you can connect up to the same virtual network, obviously. I think what you're asking is connecting two different virtual networks. Yes. That's a top ask, and that's in the plan. But unfortunately, I don't have a specific timeline I can share right now when that will be supported, though. Any other questions? All right, if not, I'll go ahead and wrap. If you have further questions, feel free to come over here, or I'll be at the booth, obviously, today and tomorrow as well, as will some of my colleagues also. So feel free to come and drop by. I hope this session was useful, and if you have further questions, you can always look me up online and also drop me emails as well. Thank you for attending.